So I want to speak a little bit about another of these paramis, and hopefully this sense of the kind of parami qualities coming together is giving us kind of a helpful route through these teachings, and it's finding the right pace for us. But it's very possible that some of the paramis that we haven't mentioned would be more helpful, more beneficial. And it's very possible that some that we already mentioned are really relevant and present now. And in fact, talking about any one parami, you kind of end up picking up a whole bunch. They're all kind of connected together. So I want to speak tonight about Panya Parami, which is meaning wisdom or discernment or clarity. Being clear about our experience. So this word discernment might be a little less familiar. So I want to just give you a little text that uses the word and kind of puts it in a place here. What kind of discernment does a practitioner have? An example is that of a practitioner who discerns clearly. This here is suffering and stress. This is how it comes to be. This is how it ceases. And this is the path of practice that leads to its ceasing. So the word discernment means to kind of separate out. So from all of the things in the world that we could pay attention to, what's regarded as being of useful discernment is recognizing where suffering and stress are, how they're coming to be, how they come to the end, and where this path of practice unfolds. Yeah. So basically, wisdom isn't to do with other things in this context. Yeah. It's to do with the resolving of dukkha, of stress, of suffering. And to be wise relates to having a wise view. Yeah. So some of you may know this kind of Eightfold Noble Path, which is the last point that the discernment refers to. This is the path of practice that leads to its ceasing, the ceasing of suffering and stress, is made up of different versions of wise, or often called right. Sort of right view, right intention, right effort, right action, you know, all of these types of things. But another way of phrasing it is wise view as this kind of fundamental thing. And there's an interesting kind of dance here that this path of practice, which is, as some of you may notice, that's actually the Four Noble Truths we just went through. The fourth truth is the eighth aspect of the path, and one of the first, well, the first limb of this path is the wise view, which includes the Four Noble Truths. So they kind of like reference each other and then cycle back through each other. So you say, you know, the way that you become free is to follow this path, and this path begins with understanding the recipe of how you become free, you know, where you place this discernment. So there's wise view in that regard. We're also sensitive around how we hold other views, you know, the views of how things are, where things go, what makes us happy, who we are. You know, we have these little views that come in there as well. We could also use the word view and wise view of actually becoming wise about what way of looking at life, what perspective, what perception we bring to experience. Okay, so that's quite a different way of meaning this. Meaning really not just the wisdom as an idea. Oh yeah, there's suffering. It's caused by this. You stop doing that. You don't get the suffering, that whole way. But also actually, how are we looking at our experience? Yeah. So we've talked a lot about how we're relating to our experience, but there's also how are we conceiving of it? How are we perceiving of it in that way? We play a part in through our attention of bringing things into being, seeing self, other, world in different ways. Yeah. So we're going to touch in on that a little bit. So as we said before, can't cover the full breadth, depth, and meaning of wisdom as this kind of parami. Yeah. Certainly not in a short talk. But, maybe it even extends beyond language in a way. And there'll be things that you know about that we're not speaking about today as well. So back to the flood. The flood is not only a flood of the hindrances, as we've spoken about them, the greed, the aversion, the restlessness, the dullness, the doubt. Yeah. It's also a flood of views. Yeah. So it's a flood made up of views, views that we hold, views that we pick up. And flood views are often quite fixed views, often quite narrow and rigid views. Yeah. Kind of inflexible. They're often unconsidered views. Yeah, views that we didn't even know we had until someone comes along and says, oh, have you ever thought about doing that? You're like, you can't do that. No, I never thought about it. Oh, maybe you can do that, actually. Do other things. Yeah, probably all have versions of that. You don't need to hear my versions. They're often inconsiderate views as well. Yeah, unconsidered and inconsiderate. I think they kind of go together. The key ones that I think the teachings point towards is views on what I need to be happy. Yeah, really important thing. We have a view, like what I need to be happy. I need whatever it is, the right food, the right temperature, someone to speak to me a certain way, and then I can be happy. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, whatever it is. But it's just interesting that we have that view. And when it doesn't, life doesn't unfold that way, then I can't be happy, or I am not happy, or I refuse to be happy, however we want to phrase that. Yeah. We have views on how the world functions, and certainly views on how the world should function. Yeah, and sometimes those two don't go together. We find ourselves with a view without a world to fit it to. Yeah, that's quite frustrating, and that's a bit of a flood. And we have views of ourselves and of others, who we feel we are, who we feel others are. Yeah. And some of these are deeply held views, deeply held ideas, quite embedded habit patterns that go along with that. But it's important to say that none of those, however deep they feel to be, are as deep as the freedom that this path offers. Yeah, it's deeper than that. It goes beyond that, right? And you go, oh, my views are so deeply ingrained. And it's like, no, like, they're quite deep, you know, they're quite sticky, quite tricky, but they're not as deep as the peace, the freedom, the well-being that's there inside of you. Yeah, pushing against those views a little bit, trying to get its way out. Yeah. And that freedom, we will know it, it will open skillfully through adopting other views, which is really interesting. Views that open our view. Yeah. Perspectives that open our perception. And that's part of what the wisdom and the discernment is about there. Yeah. So we can carry on with a view that there's something wrong with us. That can be quite a pernicious view in our culture, in our times, and the view that, you know, kind of deep down underneath that, maybe things are already peaceful and open within you. Yeah. If you go deeper, quieter into your experience, what you might find is that the hindrances, and excuse this quite disgusting image, but the hindrances are up on the surface, floating like shit on the top of an ocean. Yeah, all just like all that shit on the top. It's like going swimming through greed and aversion and restlessness. And then at a certain moment you think, oh, forget it all. Just like sink down into a moment of quietness and stillness, which also feels vast and quite easeful and open at certain times. You realize, no, actually down here it's perfectly fine. Yeah. And then, but up there, it's all that fighting over all that kind of image and stuff. That's not an official image of the Buddha, I was going to say. But I think he speaks to it at other times. The Buddha was a much better poet than I. So these views that we've taken up, we bring those into question when we practice this kind of discernment. Yeah. This is stress. This is suffering. This is how it comes to be. This is how it ceases to be. And this is the path of practice to liberate. Yeah. This is what we convert from confusion or delusion or what's often called ignorance. Yeah. I'm not calling anybody here ignorant, but there are some things that we're not paying attention to, which is kind of a cousin of ignoring. Yeah. Which is kind of a bit like ignorance. Yeah, and we bring those into the light of wisdom. So we have the capacity to know our experience. Yeah. We have the capacity to know our state of body, heart, mind. And we've been using this GOM to get to know it. Yeah. We can get to know the Vedana that Zohar spoke about, this projection of pleasant or unpleasant or neither onto our experience. And we can know that if we follow that, and we can know where does that lead? If I chase after the pleasant, if I fight against the unpleasant, I can know where this goes. We can even know this moment is a perception in consciousness right now. Yeah. This is a perception of reality, how reality is. And that might be a lot more pliable than we, changeable than we first realize. If I use any language that doesn't make sense, just let me know. Yeah, and I'll tidy it up. Not only do we know these things, we also know that we know them. Yeah. You kind of thought about that, you know, our kind of level of consciousness that we have is we are conscious of things and we're also conscious of being conscious of those things. Yeah. And then we can also be conscious of being conscious of being conscious of those things. Like it's all, there's always a bit more consciousness ready to come in and say, well, you're doing that conscious of conscious of conscious of consciousness thing. It's like, yeah. Who's doing that? And we've gone out again. So there's always a little bit more consciousness you can grab hold of by just the nature of knowing it. Yeah, it just seems to be a feature of our state or level of consciousness. We know that we know. And we can also know that we don't know. We can also know, I don't know. And it's really helpful to be able to access that. You know what? I actually don't know. I don't know which way to go. Yeah. Knowing. We spoke a bit before about knowing that we're lost. Yeah, it's very different to not knowing that we're lost. And when we know that we're lost, we know we need to seek help, need to find direction, need to stay still, stop panicking. It's normal not to know everything. Yeah. We can invite a sense of wonder there, also curiosity, inquiry. A sense that there is more to know, more to know. And that is what the factor of wisdom is suggesting in this parami. There is a way to know more, to elevate ourselves, to know the subtle and the significant. To know what's important to know. Yeah. So in these teachings, it gets right down to the essence. Know stress and suffering. Yeah. The Buddha would often speak about, you know, he stood in a vast forest where the leaves had fallen. The whole forest is full of leaves, leaves on top of leaves, layers and layers of leaves. And says, you know, the knowledge of that is received in kind of full awakening is equivalent to like all of the leaves in these forests. But like these teachings are just this one handful of leaves, like enough leaves that you can hold in your hand. I'm not sure how many leaves. Leaves that is, you know, but compared to all the leaves on the forest floor. And this is the essence. And knowing the essence, sticking to the essence, one arrives at the essential. is what's said in the teachings. All offered as a great help, yeah, for getting us out of the flood of stress and suffering and avoiding getting back into it. So remembering that flood is the flood of the hindrances, you know, chasing after things, getting overexcited, getting too dull, finding our way through all of that, but also the view that we have. Yeah. And so then all of the teachings and all of the practices are offered to us for that purpose. Yeah. They're all offered because they come from wisdom and they lead to wisdom. Yeah. But all of the practices that are offered to us, all of the teachings, all of the ideas, they all reveal something about the nature of experience. Yeah. And that understanding that nature of experience is what wisdom is about. Because we're interested in the nature of how does stress and suffering come about. And there, it's in the seed of every single experience that we have. Some degree of stress and suffering in there to learn about. How did that come about? And then we follow those patterns, we go along that path along the flood, and we find our way across. Yeah. That isn't to say that it doesn't also get pretty confusing. Yeah, it doesn't also get pretty confusing as things kind of emerge in their subtlety and nuance, and we're trying to uncover exactly what's going on. And if some of the practices have kind of been working for you in any way, the ideas that we've been exploring, you might notice that they kind of open a question about what's really happening in this body, heart, and mind. If I can influence my experience through shifting the how and the what of attention, and it changes actually how reality appears, what does that say about what we're experiencing? Yeah. Quite an interesting thing to do with perception along there. Yeah. What's really happening when the way of looking, the way of relating shapes so much what actually appears? Which it does. Pay attention to different aspects of the experience. Pay attention in different ways and your experience changes. If it didn't change, there'd be no point doing meditation. But you can't change that. Nothing to do. So here we are, changing it. And if we change it by the way that we relate to it, then how is it really? You know, so I spoke about this truthfulness, this honesty. I don't know what it is, really. Because it changes when I look at it differently. That's interesting. Something interesting that can happen with Vedana, and so I spoke about it and we all just nodded, yeah, is that she said, it changes. Like it changes over time. It changes when you relate to it differently. Right? If you meet a pleasant experience, like I think the food is tasty. I've been enjoying it, enjoying eating it. I think it's pleasant. And then I can notice I haven't even finished my plate. I want more. I want more. Is there more in the pot? Why did I sit so far from the pot? And the walk of shame back to the pot. See, there's more. And then putting it on your plate. And then you go back to the plate. And it's not quite as pleasant as it was the first time for me. Yeah. It's like a different relationship has evolved over that time. And instead of just staying there and enjoying and delighting and appreciating, I went into the greed mode and it kind of ruined the taste buds or something. I'm not sure how it really works. Yeah. So the Vedana of that experience, the pleasantness of it, depends on how I relate to it. Yeah. So how is it? Is it pleasant or is it not pleasant? Yeah, bizarre. I think that's weird, right? And then once we see all these different ways of relating to things, and like, well, then should I just, you know, meet with appreciation all the pain in my body or compassion, and then it just makes it kind of fade and open and disappear, and then, you know, I ruin my knees and you know, So what is the right thing to do? So many possibilities with all this kind of dependently originating experience dancing around. It become confusing. And I think that that's why the Buddha continuously steers us back to this question of where is the dukkha? Right? You're not here to understand how reality works, but actually here to understand how do you discern where there is suffering? How is that coming into being? How is it brought to an end? And how do we walk this path? Yeah. And we do, we have to walk this path, yeah? We have to bring it into being. And I do think that that capacity to know that we know our experience is a really important part of how we become free. We have to know that we know this is stress, this is suffering. We have to know that we know there is a way out of this. And even if we don't know the way out, just knowing there is a way out, there is a way out. But if we're not careful, we will drive ourselves into the flood. Yeah. And if we are caring, not overly careful, not overly careless, yeah, we can step out of the flood that we see in the world. The world is flooded, yeah, flooded by greed, capitalist devastation of the planet. Yeah. It's flooded by wars and competitiveness and anger and violence. Yeah. So it's important that we understand these ways that we can step away from the urge to jump into the flood, and hopefully we can live our lives in ways that will be of benefit to others, to help them out of the flood and also help them stay out. So Zohar gave us what I think is one of my favorite teachings, the two sorts of thinking. I don't know if anyone's been using that today. Just to kind of notice, you know, that the Buddha as this pre-Buddha moment, you know, I don't know if Zohar underlined that, but like before they became the Buddha, they thought, I'm going to divide my thinking into two sorts. Yeah. My greedy, aversive, harmful thoughts and my, you know, beneficial, beautiful, wholesome thoughts, and then I'm just going to have the good ones because I recognize those ones lead to suffering, those ones throw me in the flood, yeah, and so I'm going to go down that way. It's really helpful for us to acknowledge with humble honesty how much of the time we actually follow the other thoughts. Yeah, just interesting to notice that. Yeah. And hopefully inspirational. But it's difficult to stop ways of thinking because they come, like the Vedana, from the subconscious with a lot of baked-in views and ideas. And those are the things that we want to be able to challenge. Yeah. So I heard in the teachings, I didn't hear this directly from the Buddha, but I heard this from a Buddhist teacher, so I'm guessing it probably was something that the Buddha said, that we have to recognize that we want to be happy. Yeah. We want to be free. We want to be safe. We want to be well. We want to be peaceful. We want to be free in those ways. Those are my meta phrases, but I think it's the same thing. Yeah, we actually are offering beings the kind of liberation that we also want. We seek actually a kind of satisfaction, an ease, a release. But we take the Vedana projection, that'll be pleasant. If I get that, then I can be satisfied. Yeah, we take that at what I would call face value, and then we react. And because of that, we've not got a real openness to experience, a real sensitivity to depth, a real clarity of how things come and go into being, and also a clarity about what brings happiness for us. And of course, this isn't how the wise see it. And in the Dharma, the Buddha would often say, we have it the wrong way around. Yeah, we are really attracted to greed, aversion, and harmfulness thinking. And we should be really attracted to renunciation and you know, wishing well for others and compassion. That should be really attractive to us. Our friend Rob Bebert has a talk called Renunciation is Joy. And it's quite true that when you give things away, it does feel quite happiness-making. Yeah. And yet, what most of us and most adverts say is, greed is joy. Get it while it's still hot, you know. Get it while it's still in fashion or whatever. No, get a new one. There's a better one now, you know. And if we think of a moment of greed, we can see in it that we're seeking after a real independent thing, you know, flashy phone, whatever it is, yeah, that can bring us worthwhile happiness, worth the time and energy we put into getting it, yeah, because it's going to last some period of time. And during that time, it will continue radiating happiness into my soul, and I will be fulfilled, and I just need to get it. Mom, can I have it? Yeah. And the whole way of relating greed is surely not going to affect us negatively. Yeah. That's the kind of idea within the greed story. Yeah. The desire. Oh, so good. It's worth the greed. But what literally happens is that we are in the greed mode. And all that it goes with, the tightness, the contraction, the narrowness of the heart, the obsession, all that stuff. Yeah. Or a moment of aversion, which is really interesting. If you've ever had kind of sustained aversion about a person or a thing, you know, often around a person, is you have this really narrow picture of them. But if you examine it with discernment, you see it's like full of holes. It's like there's loads of bits I'm just filtering out. Anything good they ever do. No. I don't need that in the picture. Just what a bad person they are. Yeah. What a letdown on the human species. And it's like fabricate that whole view and just sustain it. Very, very subjective, filtered perspective. Yeah. And it's obvious then. Getting them away from us, or, you know, out of my existence at least, yeah, that would just be a good thing. And that whole view and that whole feeling is like full of as many holes as the greed story was, yeah. You think, wow. And for that, the price I pay for that is I get to live in aversion, which is also an unpleasant state of heart and mind, stressful, suffering. So the wise actually see instead a dependently originating path of nobility. And this, I think, is one of the most interesting things. I'll probably come back to this. I'm going to speak again on the last evening. But like the nobility, you heard of the Four Noble Truths, right? So they are, more accurately said, four views that bring you to nobility. Yeah. And they are ways of looking at experience that when you have them, it just brings this uprightness to you. You say, oh, that's suffering. And I can see why it's suffering. And I'm going to not do it. It's like, whoa, that was cool. Just to be able to do it once or twice is a pleasure. And imagine that this path is leading to us being able to sustain that. Yeah. Bring that to mind, bring that to heart mind, live with that kind of wisdom. And for that, we need to go a little bit deeper into where this stuff's coming from. Yeah. What's brought deeply into question in Wise View is, how do we get to the kind of satisfaction, contentment, peace, well-being that we seek? Yeah. So what is it we need to give up? What is it we need to take up so that we can get towards that. And I think that what we need to understand or discern or see with wisdom is the dependent origination of our experience, as Zohar was expressing it earlier. Yeah, the what, the how we pay attention. That second element of wise acceptance she shared with us today is to accept this experience is dependently originating. It's not as independent as it seems. And it will seem independent. Yeah. That's something really quite weird. How independent, dependently arising experiences seem to us. That's a real tricky area for our discernment. And that's why we need the development of clarity. And the interesting thing about the development of clarity into dependent origination, if this makes sense, is that clarity dependently originates. The clarity itself, the process of developing the clarity, is the process of also understanding dependent origination. It's like, how do you get clear? You do these kinds of practices, yeah? It comes from listening well. When somebody comes and they offer us a teaching, a practice, listen to a wise being, says, you might say something. And we think, ah. And they say something and it sounds applicable. And we start applying it. And it starts working for us. So, ah, yeah. They said, relax. Oh, that's better. You know, they said, yeah, look into this. See it this way. And we start seeing it and the insights come alive for us. Yeah. We see for ourselves. We experiment. We explore. We understand. And we bring that wisdom. And from our own deeper clarity, we can start to investigate. Okay, what are those things that I do? Or what are those things that I identify myself as being that are not continuous? Yeah. Those self-views, I am a dot, 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 whatever you tend to say to yourself. Always? In all circumstances? No exceptions? Well, okay. We start to question, bring that clarity, bring that sensitivity, yeah? And that maybe there's even that possibility to start to tune into something, you know, beneath that surface level of the top of the ocean, the shitty level of the ocean, where we can feel within our own quietness, a quiet, determined voice, seeking for more ease, more well-being. Yeah. Let's have this image that, you know, sometimes your mind's wandering away and then you kind of have this, hey, your mind's wandering away kind of voice inside. It's like, oh, yeah. You're thinking about that thing again. I think, who are you? I think, oh, it's that quiet voice inside. It's come to call me home. It says, come on home. I don't need to go over there. It's very beautiful. Feeling completely made up, but very beautiful. And so, what do these wise beings say? And they actually say something quite pertinent and important, just to cover before we get to the end. Is there are these things that sometimes get called three characteristics. That is, everything's impermanent. Yeah, everything's impermanent. And it's interesting, when you look into the teachings, that the Buddha never uses this term, the three characteristics. He actually uses this term, skillful lenses of perception. Like skillful views to adopt that actually themselves reveal the dependent origination of experience, which is what the wise view is. Yeah? So if we just go back to the Four Noble Truths, what they're saying is there's stress and there's suffering. It depends. How does this come into being? Is a question of how, what does it depend upon? Yeah. How does it cease to be? How does it dependently fade, dependently arise, dependently fade? And then what is this path? Path of practice, fading it, not doing the things that feed it, doing the things that drain it. How do we do that? How do we farm it? So these three skillful lenses is to say, things are transient. See them as transient. See them as changeable. Yeah, see them as not lasting. See them as impermanent. Why? Why would you want to see them that way? If you're grasping after something and you've got that greediness projection, this is going to last. This is the one that's, it's not going to last. Oh, then I don't need it. Yeah. It doesn't work quite that strongly for all of us all of the time, but it starts to open that perspective. And the interesting thing that we were touching on before, which is a thing called naive realism, that when we look that way, you see, oh yeah, it doesn't last. It doesn't last. By looking that way, things appear that way. That's the dependent origination of perspective, perception. So, does that make sense? Actually, as you look at things, like this breath doesn't last, this body doesn't last, that meal doesn't last. Yeah. Doesn't even last within itself. Each mouthful is different. Yeah. Each breath, each moment of the breath is different. And it feels like, well, that's a truth. That's a characteristic of existence. But what it is it's showing you a characteristic of perception. That when you look a certain way, life appears a certain way. If you look at life as if it's permanent, it will appear permanent to some degree. And when you're looking at that thing and thinking, this is permanent, perception says, yeah, permanent. Because perception is the best guess of the mind of what the world is like. And it depends on the conception, the ideas. And so we can replace it with these different ideas and have different perceptions. And why is it a wise teaching? Because it reduces the stress and distress. So particularly drawing that attention to the things that we're greedy about, things that we're aversive about, really, really skillful. But if we get ourselves into like a pleasant meditative state where we're feeling a lot of love or metta is flowing, things like that, you don't then say, it's impermanent, not worth it, don't bother. Right? We don't do that. It's not a characteristic of things. It's a lens to bring to things that you see are causing the way that you're relating to them is increasing the suffering in your existence. If there are things which are wholesome and helpful and beneficial, it doesn't make sense to apply that lens. It makes more sense just not to apply that lens. It's more wise, more discerning. You remember, it always comes down to the suffering. Stress. Yeah, it's the skillfulness. The second of these characteristics is to look at things, and it's sometimes said to look at things as if they are dukkha. Yeah, which is a really weird thing to say. I think more precisely is we look at things as actually unable to provide satisfaction. This is unable to provide the satisfaction that I'm seeking. I'm actually seeking something much deeper than that. Much deeper than what, you know, the flashy thing on the advert could provide. It's a part of that projection that arises from the unconscious with the Vedana. Have you noticed that in the Vedana? This is quite a deep point, but I think it's worth spending a moment or two just to see if I can make it clearly. Yeah. When it arises, that feeling, this will be pleasant. In the Pali, the language of the Buddha, what it literally means is, this is happiness. This has happiness. That's what the projection is. And when we see something unpleasant, in the Pali, it's dukkha. So, this is suffering. It's a projection that we layer onto things that they don't themselves possess. They can't possess those things. Why? Because the dukkha and the sukha, the happiness, are in the way that we relate to them. Yeah? They're in the way that we relate to them. So you can manage to see something and say, this contains happiness, and just manage to turn that into dukkha, can't you? I think we've all done it at least once. Yeah, grasping after it, greeting after it, fighting over it. You know, getting annoyed with someone for getting it when we didn't get it, or getting it and then realizing I didn't really want it anyway. You know, whatever it is, whatever that story goes, yeah. that we tend to think that there is satisfaction in the things. Tend to think there is dissatisfaction, right, in the things, when truly there's no satisfaction in the things themselves, from their own side. Yeah. Maybe that's hard to understand. Maybe we do need just to take a small diversion and play a quiz. Someone's giving me that face that says, I love quizzes. It wasn't that face, but I'm playing with my perception. So a quick quiz to check your energy. So we're going to imagine, some of you may know the answer, and if you know the answer, you're still allowed to guess the correct answer. Imagine that you're going to get put those anodes onto your skin to measure excitation, but we're going to take that as a proxy for happiness, right? And then you're going to be given a credit card that's got, I don't know, 500 euros. Ooh, got a lot. And you're going to go into a shop, find something that you like. You're going to find the one that fits you, looks great on you, or will look lovely in your home, whatever the thing is that you want to get. And then you're going to go to the cashier, to the till, and you'll pay with this money that you've just gotten. And you're going to go through that journey. So you're going to have these anodes put on. You're going to get given the credit card with loads of cash. You're going to find something that you really like, and you're going to go to the cashier and you're going to buy it. Okay. Now the game is, where does happiness, which admittedly it's just excitement at this level, right? It's not the deep, peaceful happiness that we're maybe all seeking, but like just as an example, when does that happiness peak? Okay. So do you have any guesses? Where do you think it peaks? They run this experiment and they have a result. So
the anticipation.
Yeah. So is that before you even get the?
No, before you actually get the peak. Like imagining that you're going to get it.
Just imagining that you're going to get it. Yeah. Lovely. Great.
At the counter. Just before you pay.
It's a good guess. And you guessed the same, yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. Lovely. Any other guesses? Where do you think you get most happiness? I know some people just hate shopping. So. anyone else? When it fits you, or you see the one you like, or any other? No? All right. So the two guys win in terms of like, how they said the experiment, how they set the results from the experiment. But I think it probably could have peaked anywhere for any of us. The point of the story, though, isn't that, but actually, where did the happiness come from? How did happiness get into the shop? And if it were there, how did it get out of you at the point where you were just about to pay for it? Or if you felt it in the anticipation, or if you felt it in the moment where you saw something. But where did it come from?
Imagination.
The imagination, yeah. It came from inside of you. Yeah. For some reason, under certain conditions, we will allow it out. Right? Only when the conditions are right. What is allowing it out? And what the Dharma teachings are saying is that we go through life clinging and craving after things, and these things as if they contain the happiness. And then we perform a magic trick on ourselves. When I get those things that I want, I agree to stop craving, I will feel that happiness, but I will pretend that it came from the thing and not from within me. Things, the teachings say, things do not contain satisfaction. The illusion of satisfaction arises because we perform this magic trick on ourselves. And it's hidden in plain sight. It's us doing it to us. And we live that way. Now, what happens when we say that dukkha depends? Dukkha depends. It depends on believing in the magic tricks we play. It depends on believing in the permanence of things. Yeah? It depends on believing on the independent nature of things. That's the third lens of perspective. things do not have an independent nature, they have a dependent nature. Selves, weathers, rooms, talks, they all have dependent natures, not independent natures. What happens when we look that way? What happens when we elevate our wisdom? What happens when we bring that through how we perceive, how we conceive? Yeah. And so this second point of discernment, how does suffering and stress come to be? How does it come to be? And many of you will know that the Buddha answers this question. It's like a rhetorical question, we should say. Blah, blah, blah. Why does it come to be? I'll tell you why it comes to be. It comes to be from tanha, this thirsting, demanding, craving, clinging, all that type of thing. But I think it's a really important question for us to ask. What else is there when there's stress and there's suffering? What disappears when there's stress and there's suffering? And those views disappear. Yeah. The constriction, the contraction, the agitation disappears and builds up, and the stress disappears. That ease, that openness. That sense of time pressure and urgency that builds up in those experiences and fades and eases in moments of more peacefulness. Yeah. The self-centeredness, what's our mention about the Vedana, yeah? This will be happiness for me. And then I will get it. And then the pursuance and all that, that builds up that sense of difference between self and other. And in those moments of happiness and ease and well-being, they fade, they open. And so this path of practice becomes one where we see Vedanas emerge with discernment, with clarity, and we see that they are projecting a sense of direction, of activity. And we can just bring into this question, am I thinking this is going to last? Something that's not going to last? Am I projecting onto it a sense of satisfaction that actually maybe would more easily come through release? Yeah. Is there something in me, it, time, that's building up contraction that I could ease and soften in that moment and guide myself back towards well-being? Yeah. In that final sense, that maybe wisdom invites us into that sense of wonder, this open question of how experience comes to be, how experience fades. And allowing us to be a being that doesn't even seek more experience, but really seeks to understand experience. To explore experience, to understand it like a deeply rooted being, yeah. And to open out above experience, like a sublime, vast openness. Within which we're able to try on different lenses and different ways of meeting those multiple meanings of wise view, skillful view, wholesome view. Adopting the view, the lens, the perspective that brings freedom and leads us into that deeper wise view of what brings us to the end of suffering, what serves the path that we're walking. Let's have a quiet minute together. Close. Thank you for your listening, your presence, and your practice.